this, a handful, a mere 20, according to their report, made up the bulk of these contributions, between them donating more than $600 million. By the time the election was held on November 8, ATF estimated the total donations made by U.S. billionaires would top $1 billion. Indeed, in late October, the Washington Post calculated that the top 50 political donors had injected $1.1 billion into political races this expensive election season. Percent of these donations went to Republican Party candidates, although liberal billionaires George Soros and Michael Bloomberg also pumped huge sums into the elections, with the intent of shoring up Democratic congressional representation and pushing back against some of the anti-democracy forces coursing through the body politic these days. Sam Bankman-Fried, the young cryptocurrency guru, also donated tens of millions of dollars to pro-democratic PACs, presumably before his business empire suddenly crumbled in the first part of November. In 2022, largely out of the public eye, billionaire PayPal founder Peter Thiel bankrolled candidates like Arizona Senate hopeful Blake Masters and J.D. Vance, the newly elected senator from Ohio, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. Building supply magnate Diane Hendricks spent $16 million propping up Ron Johnson's campaign for re-election as senator from Wisconsin, according to ATF data. The intervention was probably critical to sustaining the unpopular Johnson, arguably Donald Trump's most vocal apologist in the Senate, in the last weeks of the campaign as his Democratic opponent Mandela Barnes surged to within a point of victory in the election. Hendricks' donations came up on top of more than $20 million that she and fellow billionaires Dick and Liz Ollehane donated to Johnson's campaign in 2016. What did these billionaires get from their investment? A pliant senator willing to use his public office to push for amendments to tax legislation that would save his billionaire patrons hundreds of millions of dollars in reduced taxes. In New York, Ronald Lauder of the Estee Lauder Cosmetics fortune spent $11 million boosting GOP gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin in his race against Democratic incumbent Kathy Hochul. The money didn't ultimately swing the election to Zeldin, but it did contribute to significantly narrowing the gap between the two candidates, and likely was influential in bringing out enough GOP voters to flip a critical number of states' congressional seats from the blue to red, results that might produce the margin of victory nationally for the GOP to regain control of the House of Representatives. In Los Angeles, mayoral hopeful Rick Caruso, a billionaire mall developer, has spent roughly $100 million of his own money in an advertising blitz that's eclipsed by a factor of roughly 13 to 1 Karen Bass's spending in the last month of the campaign and turned him into a viable candidate for taking the reins in City Hall. As of this writing, with slightly less than half the votes counted, Caruso has a 2% lead over Bass. The money injected into the political process by the super wealthy is just the tip of the corporate influence iceberg created by the Citizens United decision and told between super wealthy donors, corporations, and smaller donations, nearly $17 billion was spent on the 2022 midterm elections, according to an analysis by Open Secrets. In the five most contested Senate races alone, $1.3 billion was burnt through. No other country on earth spends anywhere near as much during its election season. The disproportionate influence played by a handful of billionaires and by OPEC outside spending groups on the country's political system isn't healthy for democracy. Yes, the country dodged a bullet in the recent election by rejecting election deniers who sought to capture critical state offices in order to undermine the integrity of election systems. Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the U.S. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal. And to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering,
the pain, the injuries, deaths and damage should never go beyond by even a millimeter what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. When I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with a cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he
survives.
If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the the cases we have, we register, the incidence about 14.7 per 1,000 live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per 1,000. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great because it's really effective and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards,
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones. That we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground. What do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority. And only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces continue their attacks against Palestinians. What is disappointing is the inaction from world community and the so-called defenders of human rights. In this regard, we have provided views from world media websites. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada had this headline, writing, "Why are Israel's cops a strategic partner for EU?" This website noted, "Supporters of the Israeli regime, believe it or not, get one or two things right. The constant claim that their beloved regime cherishes innovation contains a grain of truth. What other oppressive views Facebook and Twitter as such vital tools for alerting the world to its brutality?" On October 8, the Zionist regime police force effectively admitted that it was subjugating civilians en masse. The force posted photographs on the internet of its officers helping to seal off Shafat's refugee camp near Al-Quds. The Zionist regime presented the suffocation of Shafat as a response to the killing of an Israeli troop. Collective punishment is forbidden under the Geneva Conventions and other instruments of international law. Every time it resorts to collective punishment, the Zionist regime commits a war crime. Avoiding democratic oversight, the European Union has built a formal alliance with the Zionist regime's police. The EU even signed an accord on deepening ties with Israeli regime's police during September. just a few weeks before that force implicitly boasted of committing a war crime in Shafat camp. Though that occurred, the Zionist regime can exchange personal data about Palestinians living under occupation with Europol, the EU's police agency. The deal was put together quite swiftly by EU standards. Negotiations aimed at sealing it kicked off in November 2021. Around the same time that the talks opened, the Israeli regime sent a delegation of 30 high-ranking diplomats to Brussels. Among the many officials they met were Laurent Michel from the Migration and Home Affairs Department of the European Commission, the EU's executive. A briefing note prepared for Michel's discussions obtained under Freedom of Information rules states that Israel is a strategic partner country for the EU on security cooperation. The accord signed in September this year follows on from a 2018 working arrangement between the Israeli regime and Europol. The briefing note for Michel contends that there should be even stronger cooperation with the Zionist regime. It points out that Europol assists the national authorities of EU governments in identifying cross-border links to organized crime. The Israeli contribution in such cases continues to be of utmost importance, it adds. Since the 2018 arrangement entered into force, the Israeli regime has established a liaison office at Europol's headquarters in The Hague. Such steps offer considerable potential to promote operational contribution, the briefing note says. The 2018 arrangement gives a list of crimes on which the Zionist regime and Europol may work together. They include terrorism and war crimes. It stipulates, too, that information exchanged between the two sides must not be collected in obvious violation of human rights. Joke? Was that somebody's idea of a joke? The Zionist regime's police force, as already noted, actively commits war crimes while serving a state that labels all forms of resistance to its systematic violence as terrorism. The Zionist regime systematically uses torture against Palestinians in so-called terrorism investigations, methods which are officially sanctioned and carried out with impunity. The fact that the Zionist regime's police force is based in occupied East Al-Quds should be sufficient to rule out any dealing with it. Despite opposing the Zionist regime's colonization of East Al-Quds on paper, the EU has embraced a police force which plays an integral part in colonization. And what does obvious violation of human rights mean in this context? Does the EU seriously want the Israeli regime to be a little more subtle in the way it subjugates Palestinians? The Zionist regime's police force is not the only despicable body to enjoy a metaphoric message from EU representatives lately. The EU's embassy in Tel Aviv has just teamed up, and not for the first time, with the European Leadership Network, perhaps the most deceptively named outfit in the Zionist regime's army of professional lobbyists. Both the embassy and the European Leadership Network recently hosted a conference for experienced diplomats, officials, and experts. Among the few details published about the event were that it discussed Russia's tension with Ukraine. It is a safe thing that the participants were too polite to denounce the Israeli regime's aggression against Palestinians. Senior figures in the European Leadership Network have raised funds to support that aggression. At one point, the group even counted Michael Herzog, now the Zionist regime's ambassador to the U.S., among its management. He had a significant role in planning a 2002 bombing raid on Gaza, in which 8 children were killed. Don't expect the EU to shun the butchers of Palestinian children. The fabricated regime of Israel, after all, is a strategic partner for the EU.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. There are a handful of other verses at the end of Surah Anfal which restate the duties associated with faith mentioned here, such as prayer, zakat, holding fast to Allah. It also mentions some duties associated with faith from another perspective. Let us turn to these now. Indeed, those who have believed and migrated and struggled with their possessions and their persons, and against their possessions and their persons, and those who gave them shelter when they were refugees without a home, and helped They are guardians of one another. They are bound together and on the same side. They are of a single substance. They are the bricks and mortar of a single structure.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The likeness of the faithful is like an edifice. They support one another. Have you seen how these bricks go together in these ornate ceilings? Each brick is a single believer. Each believer is a single brick. They fit together and support one another. Together they form a structure that takes great effort to demolish. Tens of bricks side by side. This one brick helps to protect the whole, and the whole all help to protect this one brick. They are guardians of one another. Held together by strong bonds, united. And those who have believed. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 72. Pay attention here. What about those who have believed, who have faith in their hearts, but did not migrate? They believed, but they didn't act on the moral duties that arise from their faith. What about them? You have no guardianship, wilayah, in relation to them until they migrate. These are not bound to you. They are not a part of you. There is no relationship or guardianship between the two of you. Until when? Until they migrate. Until they follow through on the moral duties to which faith is attached. Hollowed out faith is no use in this world, dear brother. It does not produce any effects on the Islamic society. As for the hereafter, this is a separate discussion. You have no guardianship in relation to them until they migrate. There is another verse which is very relevant to what we are discussing here, and it comes just a few verses after those we have been discussing. Allah says, those who have believed, migrated, and struggled in the way of Allah, and those who gave them shelter and helped, it is they who are the truly faithful. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 74. So, if those who emigrate, struggle, give shelter and help are the truly faithful, What are everyone else? They are false believers. Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
More than 7 years have passed since the Saudi aggression against Yemen, and the only achievement of the aggressor from this crime is the killing and displacement of millions of innocent people in the shadow of the silence of the United Nations and human rights institutions. Both the United States and Britain have played a malicious role in thwarting peace efforts in Yemen. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television network has more for us on this story. Yemen's popular resistance movement Ansar Allah warns about the United States and Britain's fresh malicious intentions in the war-ravaged country. Referring to Yemen's biggest province, which spans from the country's center towards its eastern areas, Ali Al-Qahoum, a member of Ansar Allah's political bureau, said, "There is a direct U.S. military presence in Yemen and an influx of U.S. forces, specifically in Hadhramaut province." Referring to Yemen's second largest province that neighbors Hadhramaut to the east, he added, "There is also an influx of British forces into Al-Mahra." The United States and Britain were preparing for a fresh round of escalation in Yemen, he further warned without elaborating. "The Western countries have been contributing heavily and unabatedly to a war of aggression that the Saudi Arabia-led coalition has been waging against Yemen since 2015. The coalition has been seeking unsuccessfully, though, to restore Yemen's power to the country's former Western and Riyadh-aligned officials. The war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis." Washington and London have been providing the coalition with direct arms, logistical and political support, including through outfitting it with precision-guided ammunition that the Saudi-led military forces have been using against the civilian population of Yemen. Al-Qahoum said new U.S. and British military delegations had arrived in Yemen recently. Reporting on Wednesday, 2nd of November, Yemeni media cited informed local sources as saying that had removed provincial governor Mahbood bin Mahdi, had held a face-to-face meeting with the U.S. delegation in his office. However, the Ansarullah official asserted that despite the Western states' apparent preparations for a new flare-up in Yemen, the Yemenis are ready to defend their dignity and every inch of their country. Yemen's press agency has more for us on this story. Amid Washington's aggressive attempts to wrest control over energy reserves and plunder natural resources in conflict-plagued Yemen, a new batch of U.S. military forces has entered the country's oil-rich eastern province of Hadhramout. Citing informed local sources who asked not to be named, the agency reported that Hadhramout provincial governor Mahbood bin Mahdi had had a face-to-face meeting with a U.S. delegation in his office. During the meeting, Mahbood bin Mahdi complained to the American military officials about the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government's decision to ban the Saudi-led coalition from exporting the Yemeni crude oil, asserting that the decision would have adverse effects on the global energy market. The development comes as visits by Western officials to eastern Yemen has lately witnessed an accelerating trend, the most recent of which was the visit of French ambassador to Aden, Jean-Marie Safa, in late September. The visits are viewed as Western effort to secure its energy needs against the backdrop of the Russian special operation in Ukraine. Back on 28th of July, a batch of U.S. military forces landed at Al-Qaeda Airport in Yemen's southeastern province of Al-Mahra on board a flight from Riyadh International Airport in Mukalla, which lies on the shores of the Arabian Sea and about 480 kilometers east of Aden. The Yemen press agency reported at the time that the arrival of the U.S. forces was followed by a major disruption to internet connectivity in the Seyhout district, blaming the internet blackout on the installation of sophisticated surveillance devices by American military forces. Earlier, a top-ranking Yemeni official said U.S. and British military trainers had arrived at a port in Mahra province on vessels loaded with munitions as well as military and logistical equipment. The provincial governor, Al-Qatabi Ali Hussein Al-Faraj, said on 26th of June that large arms shipments about military vessels disembarked at the port of Nishtun and that British and American military trainers were stationed at Al-Qaeda International Airport. Faraj said at the time, the Saudi-led coalition of aggression is involved in the smuggling and trade of narcotics in the area in order to perpetuate insecurity, to advance its goals and deter the local population from confronting the invaders. Yemen's official Sabah news agency has more for us. The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council has hit out at U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, for scuttling efforts to extend the United Nations brokered truce, describing the truce situation in the country as a time bomb. Mahdi al-Mashat said in Sana'a on Monday, 7th of November, "We are in a no-peace, no-war state. While we had reached a good level of understanding during previous rounds of talks, the American envoy's trip to the region thwarted these efforts." Referring to Lenderking's journey to the region starting on 11th of October to purportedly support the United Nations-led negotiations to extend truce in Yemen, al-Mashat said, "While the U.S. envoy pretends to be a peace dove, he's rather an ill-omened owl." Mahdi al-Mashat said, "Some aggressor countries which benefit from the war in Yemen are pushing the country towards a political and military explosion, citing the U.S. envoy's malicious role in the failure of the peace talks. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war in Yemen back in March of 2015 in collaboration with its Arab allies. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abdurrabb Mansour Hadi and crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement of Yemen, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Sana'a. But the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives. The United Nations brokered truce between the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen first came into effect back in April and has been extended twice since then. In mid-October, Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf said there would be no talks about the extension of the six-month truce, which expired on 2nd of October, unless the nation's legitimate demands were fully met. He stressed that the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government will make every effort to establish just and dignified peace throughout the country.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, democracy and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
È la prima
nave.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while four passengers with serious